Good morning, everyone. Thank you all for being here. I'm Andrea Pelliccia from the J.P. Morgan Healthcare Investment Banking. It is a pleasure for me to introduce Zandy Forbes, President and CEO of MeiraGTx. Before leaving the stage, just logistical note, there will be a Q&A session on Yorkshire Room at the end of the presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and thank you to J.P. Morgan for inviting us to speak today. I'm very happy to be able to present an overview of MeiraGTx to you. So I bring your attention to our forward-looking statements. First of all, I'll give you a quick company overview. We are a young company. We formed about 3.5 years ago, and we IPO'd only in June. When you think about Meira as a gene therapy company, how we aimed to build the company was not just to take an academic program in a particular area and bring it through clinical development to approval, but really to build a company that was a fully integrated gene therapy company that could use this new modality of gene therapy to treat not only rare inherited diseases, but many other sorts of diseases in a cost-effective fashion. So one of the foundations that the company was built on was a completely innovative technology to regulate genes using riboswitches, switches, which I'll mention slightly at the end of the talk. But in actually being able to build a gene therapy company that can run clinical trials and bring things to the market, we focused on a few things. First of all, manufacturing. So we have built, over the last few years, our own 29,000 sq ft manufacturing facility, which can supply all of our clinical needs and all of our commercial needs. And it was built in collaboration with the regulatory agencies. It's GMP certified. And the important thing about this facility is that it's both flexible and scalable. And we have a platform of viral vector technology. We develop our own promoters. We choose different capsids for every one of our target products. And every product that we take into the clinic is one that's been optimized specifically for that particular indication. We have a quite deep clinical pipeline at the moment, a lot of which we acquired, some preclinically, some already passing through clinical development. But when we were looking in the world of gene therapy at what our first clinical targets would be, we looked not only for human proof of concept in many cases, but we treat with small doses in encapsulated areas. So we try to avoid the issues that others have come across when they're treating the liver or treating for DMD, where you're using massive amounts of vector and you face immunological challenge, because that really is one of the issues in gene therapy that we still all face today. So we have a pipeline with currently five clinical programs. A large part of our pipeline is in rare eye disease. Now, it looks like we're doing a lot, and we are, but we consider the rare eye disease area as almost one program because there's so much synergy between the regulatory and the clinical operations that really we're using the same surgery, the same CMC, the same type of interactions with the regulatory agencies, which has allowed us in this area to advance quite a lot of programs quite rapidly and enroll a large number of patients quickly. We do have an AMD program, which is in IND-enabling studies now. Our most advanced program, which we acquired last year, is actually we have two positive studies. One is a phase 1, one is a sham-controlled phase 2, and that we're talking to the regulatory agencies about a path to approval. And then our third clinical program, again, is slightly unusual for gene therapy. It doesn't treat an inherited disease, but it treats the consequence of being cured of head and neck cancer, which is you can't produce saliva anymore. And I'll talk about that as well a bit later. But first, our ocular franchise. One of the reasons we've been able to advance this so rapidly and efficiently is we acquired the preclinical assets from the University College London. This is one of the leading gene therapy institutes in the world. But important for translational development of these products is a relationship with the Moorfields Eye Hospital. This is critical because in IRDs, it's an unusual situation globally for any set of diseases, in that there is one hospital in the world that sees more IRD patients than any other center, and that's the Moorfields Eye Hospital. We work with great centers in the US as well, Mass Eye and Ear, Kellogg, Casey. We have a partnership with the largest charity in the US, the Foundation for Fighting Blindness. And I just want to give you the scale of the importance of Moorfields by saying the last time I was at Mass Eye and Ear, they had around 1,300 rare eye disease patients of all genotypes, and the Moorfields has 15,000. So this is really critical for a number of reasons. The Moorfields had a large number of natural history studies ongoing that we have taken over, and that was actually UCL as well. And that allows us to not only rapidly take patients into our studies, but also we have well-characterized patients and we know the patient population that we're treating. And we're really able to look at what these diseases are and what the best endpoints are for showing the benefit of our products when we treat patients. And just down on the right-hand side, again, to emphasize how important our relationships with Moorfields and other centers are, is that is an independent study of the ability to enroll a rare eye disease program globally. And you can see the Moorfields was able to three times over-enroll the patients in that study, but no center in the U.S. could get there. It's very hard to do these studies only in the U.S. Our first IRD program I'm going to talk about is in achromatopsia. And this is not a degenerative disease. This is a disease where babies are born blind. Their cones don't work. So that rather than being able to see in light of this level, they feel something akin to pain. And this lasts throughout life. So patients are blind from the day they're born, and they have photoaversion, photophobia throughout life. And many patients feel that this is one of the most debilitating things about their disease. So you can tell a baby who has achromatopsia, you take them out of their bedroom and they squint and they start screaming. So the achromatopsia, it's a genetic disease. It's quite large for inherited retinal disease, about 20,000 patients, a few more in the big three markets. And it's largely caused by a mutation in one of two genes which prevent the channel that conducts electricity in the cones from forming. So we have a construct that's been optimized to each of those different forms of achromatopsia, CNGB3 and CNGA3. We use different promoters. We use the capsid that was most effective in treating the null animal model and obviously the gene CNGA3 or B3. This is the sort of preclinical data we have for achromatopsia. On the top left-hand side, you see a peak of electrical response in a normal mouse's eye, which goes away in the middle when you remove the CNGB3 gene. On the right, you treat with our vector, that electrical response returns. What's really nice is that you can test the level of vision that a mouse sees, and a young mouse treated with our vector, you put them in this cage with a spinning disc around them, and we can recapitulate the vision of a normal mouse by treating these blind mice with our vector. So this data is actually very strong for preclinical data, and based on this preclinical data, as well as safety in adults in our study, we got PRIME designation in Europe with this program. So where are we? We do dose escalation studies in adults for all of our programs. We have completed treating adults and pediatrics. three different doses from 1 times 10 to the 11 to 1 times 10 to the 12. And we've treated 11 adults, 9 pediatrics by the end of December last year. And we will be releasing data on this full study up to date in the third quarter. That's 6 months after the last pediatric was treated, which is the first time that everyone in the study has gone through each of their assessments. We have multiple regulatory designations for all of these programs, so orphan status, rare pediatric designation, prime and fast track, and CNGA3, we actually have been allowed by the agencies to move directly into a pediatric study prior to going into adults. So we don't have to do that year-long dose escalation in adults. That was based on looking at our CNGB3 program, the safety and the severity of the disease. So our next program I'm going to talk about, another inherited retinal disease, is almost the opposite of achromatopsia in that it's degenerative. And in this case, patients start off with relatively normal vision. They lose night vision in their teenage years. Then they get tunnel vision. By the time they're 30 or 40, they're completely blind. And this is the most common form of inherited retinal disease, retinitis pigmentosa. And we treat the most common genotype of X-linked retinitis pigmentosa called RPGR. So we have a stabilized cDNA, which we have expressed through a rhodopsin kinase promoter in both rods and cones, and it's in AAV5. This is some preclinical data in a mouse. In the very important thing about RPGR is it's in these little cilial regions of the photoreceptors, and it's required for the distribution of these proteins, the photoreceptor proteins. You remove RPGR, and you lose the correct distribution, and you actually get a degenerated retina, so it loses that electrical response. You treat with our vector, and you get all of that back. But what's really exciting, and this is my favorite data in RPGR, is that at MIRA, we actually use human retinal organoids to test our vectors and to develop our promoters. So what I'm showing you at the bottom, this is a retina grown in a dish from a normal person, stained with a marker of photoreceptor function, polyglutamylation of tubulin. This is a retina from a patient who is blind because they have an RPGR mutation. When we treat RPGR human retinas with our vector, you can see this pink staining down here is the RPGR localized to the correct place, and you start getting back this functional marker of photoreceptors. And this is in human mutations, so it's very encouraging. We have a similar design study. We have completed dose escalation in adults. This actually included teenagers of 18 and 19. So the target population, we've treated one pediatric. We're discussing the nature of the expansion cohort in up to 30 patients in the first half of this year. We have the natural history study supplying these patients into our phase 1-2 study, and we will be releasing data on the dose escalation in the middle of the year. RPE65 deficiency, a smaller indication. Here we optimize the vector based on a previous vector. In this case, we change the capsid to 5, we optimize the promoter, we codon optimize, we change the RNA stability, and the original study done in 2008 used this vector. We have improved the potency of our vector by about 3 logs. This study has completed. We treat everyone with subretinal injection under the fovea, and we expect to release top-line data from that study in the next few months. So as a summary of our IRD pipeline, CNGB3, we've completed the dose escalation in pediatrics and adults, and we'll have top-line data in the third quarter. CNGA3, we're allowed to move directly into pediatrics in our phase 1-2 study. RPGR, again, we've completed dose escalation. You'll see data sometime in the middle of the year on that whole cohort of patients. And RPE65, we've completed treating in adult and pediatrics, and the top line data from the full study will be in the next few months. Neurodegenerative disease. I'm going to talk here about our Parkinson's program, which is our most advanced program and the newest to the company, but we're very excited about it because it's unusual in having sham-controlled data. So Parkinson's disease, as you all know, is very common, it's very expensive, and it's currently treated with dopamine and dopamine agonists. However, those treatments only tend to last for 5 to 10 years, after which the patients are left with movement disorders which are uncontrollable. There are current treatments which involve deep brain stimulation and lesioning of the brain, and there are about 300,000 of these patients in the US who are no longer treatable with these oral treatments. Now, just a very broad overview of what the motor regions in the brain are, so you can follow me when I'm talking about our program. So Parkinson's disease is principally manifest as a movement disorder. Voluntary movement in the brain is controlled by these little regions called the basal ganglia that interact in multiple positive and negative interaction pathways to form a circuitry that controls motor output to the motor cortex. GABA is an inhibitory part of the pathway, and glutamate, excitatory. So in Parkinson's, what happens is dopamine neurons from the substantia nigra die, and what ends up happening is this whole circuitry is messed up. The upshot is that one of the nuclei, the subthalamic nucleus, is hyperactive. Too little GABA comes in and too much glutamate goes out. The subthalamic nucleus is the site of deep brain stimulation. So if you calm it down, you can improve the motor symptoms, or if you lesion it with surgery. So our approach is not to address the dopamine issues, but to completely bypass that and address the consequence of what happens to this circuitry when you lack dopamine. And we put into the subthalamic nucleus, so the area that is hyperactive, the enzyme that converts glutamate to GABA, so it converts the exciting neurotransmitter to the calming neurotransmitter. So in our phase one study, this had 12 patients, and these were advanced Parkinson's. We saw no treatment-related side effects, no immune responses, and importantly, we saw an improvement in motor function on the side that had been treated. And very interestingly, we also saw through PET scan a calming of the basal ganglia with respect to metabolism and activity, and an increase in the response in the motor cortex. That was treating one side of the brain. We've completed a phase two study. This is important. It's randomized, double-blind, sham-controlled study. 45 patients, relatively advanced Parkinson's disease, bilateral treatment. So both sides of the brain were treated. And in this study, we met the primary endpoint with statistical significance, which is a change in the UPDRS Part 3 score, which is the motor score, overall, compared to sham or placebo. So we saw an improvement, and we also saw an increased number of responders compared to sham. Why this is important is Parkinson's is very susceptible to placebo, and when we do a detailed analysis of both the PET imaging of these sham patients and who these sham patients were, it appears that while these GAD patients are the same individuals that respond over 6 and 12 months, the sham patients are changing. So we've got a very large difference between persistent response in the treatment arm and in the sham arm, and this is reflected in a change in the metabolism and circuitry of the brain. So in summary, this is a large indication. We've got two positive studies, significant improvement in the motor symptoms, significant reductions in medical complications, and what's interesting to these patients is that and the physicians, is we treat using the same surgery technique as deep brain stimulation. So all over the country, there are surgeons who know, who are familiar with this sort of treatment. And it's similar to deep brain stimulation, except there's no indwelling machinery, and you have none of the spreading complications that come from electricity moving outside of the subthalamic nucleus. Anyway, we're talking to the FDA about our path to regulatory approval. Next is radiation-induced xerostomia, very severe disorder caused by the lack of saliva from the salivary glands after you've been cured of head and neck cancer. These patients don't have water-conducting tissue anymore, so we actually put a water channel into their salivary glands. Oh, my goodness. A water channel into their salivary glands, which allows water to flow through. A previous study has been done in which you've seen an increase in conduction of water. This is saliva volume. And importantly, a decrease in the feeling of dry mouth in these patients. We're in a phase one study at the NIH. We're starting a phase 1-2 study at Memorial Sloan Kettering and other sites this year. And we hope to have some open-label data by the end of the year. Gene regulation. Very, very quickly before I move to manufacturing. This is really innovative technology, all of which was being developed in-house, and we have patents covering all of this technology. But we have developed a cassette which allows you to regulate different transgenes with different small molecules. So not only can you regulate where genes are expressed with promoters and delivery, but we can now regulate, using a small molecule, the time and dose at which you can express gene therapies. We do this by using RNA shape. We put into our cDNA a shape that a piece of RNA sequence that folds into, I'll call it a toxic shape. So you get no protein, you get no RNA, and you get no expression. When we add the small molecule, that entire toxic shape is spliced out. You get the perfect message and high expression of the protein therapeutic. Very quickly, some examples in cells without the inducer cassette in there, no expression. These are different cassettes, no expression. When you add the small molecule, we can get different levels of expression in cells, mammalian cells. This is mammalian cells. You can induce multiple times over time, and similarly in AAV delivered to the liver of a mouse, we're able to induce with individual doses the expression of this gene from a very low level. Importantly here, our dynamic range of expression is up to 5,000-fold. So when you look at synthetic biology papers, they're published on a 1.5 or 2-fold induction. Our induction levels in cells has got over to over 5,000-fold. Finally, and potentially most important, in order to do all of these things, we need to be able to manufacture our viral vectors. So from the very beginning of the company, some of the first people we hired were experts in viral vector manufacturing. We hired James Christie, who had just built the manufacturing facility that Novartis uses for their approved lentivirus. From Novartis, we hired Ian Delmage, our head of quality. So we put together a very pharma-level manufacturing team. Our production manager actually came from that Novartis supplying facility. In addition to this high-quality team who had experience in GMP commercial viral vector manufacturing, we have in place a very strong process development team. So our facility, as I said, is scalable and flexible. We have every room a different air handling unit. It's a single-use philosophy, so we can change the use of every room. There's very little downtime. It's about 3 days between each of these rooms. 2 cell rooms are ongoing at all times, so you've always got your cells ready when you need to make virus. 3 different viral vector suites, so we can make multiple different runs of different viral vectors consecutively. And just to give you a feel of the scale, if we had one virus being produced at our largest scale, 500 liter, In a year, we could make between 14 and 15 million doses of an iDose, of a 1 times 10 to the 12 dose in a year. This is what it looks like, basically extremely clean. And this just reiterates why it's so important for us to have our own facility, because, as I said, we've got potentially 4 pivotal programs in the next 18 months and 3 IND-ready programs. To make the vector, to actually start these studies, you need to be in control of your own supply. And that's what we've put in place over the last 3 years. It's, oh my goodness, let me just stop my timer. It's certified and we're producing GMP material now. Highlights, I've really said all these things, but I hope I've shown you that we've got a diverse program with our CNG-A3, which is going to start soon, 6 clinical programs, data from RPE65, RPGR, CNG-B3 in the next 9 months, A3 will start, open label data from our new xerostomia study by the end of the year, and we'll have a path to regulatory approval sometime during the middle of the year after discussions with the FDA. We've got manufacturing, transformative gene regulation technology, and as of our last filing, $88.6 million in cash. And that's it. And we have a breakout in the Yorkshire Room.